This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And you know, you can listen to The Takeaway anytime by subscribing to our podcast. You can find that on our website, thetakeaway.org, or on iTunes. A beer with the president. On the agenda, can we all get along? Maybe not.
I thought it was interesting how you discuss race over beer. That was the most important thing. Like, let's get the white dude and the black dude come to the White House and we'll have some beers over it. You know, like, it seems kind of ridiculous. No, wait, no, is it ridiculous? No, it's actually quite awesome.
Beer drinkers throughout the world await the outcome of a meeting between Professor Gates, Officer Crowley, and President Obama at a little watering hole on Pennsylvania Avenue called the White House. Tall, frosty conversations about race on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Have a tall frosty on us, won't you? Good morning. It's Thursday, July 30th. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week, former speechwriter, political analyst on the show. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
So on the program, wireless everywhere. What's an American to think? Rolling the dice on the flu vaccine, the difficulty of finding news you can actually use, and a hospital's cash bleed over health care coming up. But first, Amy, beer, race, a pair of professors, a cop at the White House. There's a rich brew.
Oh, it's practically frosting with political implications, which is why we're talking to Patrick Henry Bass, not in the beer. Patrick Henry Bass is an Essence senior editor and Takeaway contributor this morning. Good morning, Patrick.
Good morning, Amy.
So, quick question. Can race problems really be solved under this media floodlight this afternoon?
I think the only person missing from this debate is Dr. Phil. So what I'd like to see is, I'd like to see Crowley and Gates on Dr. Phil. And they will really have a teachable moment.
Well, please stick around, Patrick. Stay with us after the break.
Patrick Henry Bass, Essence senior editor. We're going to talk seriously about this meeting later on at the White House in just a moment. But first, everything you need to know in the news. What's on the menu at the White House Brewfest tonight? Officials have confirmed the president will be swigging a Bud Light. The White House says they'll stock Red Stripe and Blue Moon for Gates and Crowley. Health officials, this is a serious story, recommending the first H1N1 vaccines be given to pregnant women, healthcare workers, and children older than 6 months. We're going to talk more about that this segment. And on the Hill, House leaders say they've reached a shaky deal with Democrats who've been holding up the House health care bill. The deal could cut $100 billion from the plan. Amy?
Congress is acting fast to make sure federal money gets out the front door for unemployment checks so it doesn't run out while it's on August recess. Emergency legislation has passed the House, and the Senate is expected to take action soon. A federal judge hears arguments today on whether a Guantanamo Bay detainee will be released or moved to the U.S. to face criminal charges after 6 years of imprisonment. He's held for allegedly wounding two U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. It's unclear how old he is. The Pentagon say a bone scan showed he was about 17 at the time of the arrest.
Big arrest, 30 people arrested on charges of Medicare fraud, a big bust carried out across the country by hundreds of federal agents. The suspects are accused of defrauding the government of $16 million, the third major Medicare fraud sweep since May. Markets mostly flat yesterday. The Dow opens next hour at 9071. The S&P starts at 975. The NASDAQ begins at 1968. Futures trading suggests a positive open when Wall Street opens in about 90 minutes. So Obama, Gates, and Crowley get together for a beer. Will it solve the race problem? When has beer helped?
It can help, I guess, cure a lonely heart.
See, stories like that, that's what we want. Call us 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes, who's joining me all week. So let's see. Gates, Obama, and Crowley meet at the White House for a beer. I'm confused. Wasn't it George W. Bush, the one that everyone wanted to have a beer with?
Right. The voters said that they'd like to sit down, even though he didn't actually drink beer.
Right. There's another irony. That's just one of the reasons this is a convoluted story.
Interesting. Well, listen, I think Robert Gibbs, though, the president's press secretary, he sort of gives the photo op White House strategy away. Listen to this.
I think the picture alone will communicate that despite the incident, despite what happened, despite what was said after that, we can still sit down and discuss issues that are important like this, that we can, I think as the president has said many times, disagree without being disagreeable, and I think it'll be a poignant moment.
Poignant moment. Yeah, I have lots of pictures of me drinking beer. Poignant moments. They're in a shoebox somewhere. I don't think I would share those pictures. So continuing now with Patrick Henry Bass, Essence senior editor and a contributor to The Takeaway. It's not exactly a cross-section of America, you know, Patrick. Race, beer, two professors, one president, the White House, a cop from Cambridge, Massachusetts. I mean, is there any buzz in the African-American community about all this? Not that you represent everyone there, but I mean, is this actually going to contribute to something here?
I don't know if our numbers are going to go up for Oktoberfest. But we're having Oktoberfest in August here. What's surprising and fascinating is the lack of outrage that you hear within the African-American community around, you know, LaFair Gates. Professor Gates is not Rosa Parks. Racial profiling is an extremely, extremely sensitive issue with great historic and systemic challenges.
When you say Professor Gates is not Rosa Parks, what do you mean?
I mean that once the details of what happened, you know, with the arrests, once the details began to spring out in barbershops, I have a barbershop and beauty parlor, you know, and I use that as ground zero for everything that happens in the African-American community.
That's good.
But as details began to spring out, it appeared that there was an overreaction on both sides. And I think what happened with Professor Gates was there was an overestimation of his celebrity. We've seen this before with Cynthia McKinney, you know, in 2006 on Capitol Hill, where she wasn't wearing her lapel pin and she ended up punching an officer in the chest because he didn't recognize her because he tried to stop her. We had Oprah Winfrey and Gail King in France at an Hermes store. They were turned away because Hermes said that they thought that they were Northern Africans, and I'm not sure whether Oprah and Gail were wearing fezes, but you know that they were turned.
And the store, they said they were closed or something.
They said they were. Yeah. Well, right, but it became an international incident and affair. So, you know, someone as recognizable as a billionaire who's watched by hundreds of millions of people around the world can have a moment where, you know, she is turned away or every light doesn't turn green for her that particular day. And for Professor Gates, every light for him didn't turn green that way. Once he stepped outside his house and continued his anger with the police officer, you know, all heck broke loose. And I think more and more African Americans, once, as well as all Americans, once the details began to spring out, it was understandable Gates' reaction, but it was also understandable Crowley's reaction. Mm.
You want to get Gates's grad students in here to ask what they would think of his demeanor. You know, they've probably seen him up close and personal.
So you're saying that Professor Gates, he's not necessarily popular in the African American community.
No,
is that
I wouldn't say that. I'm saying he may be overestimating his popularity. You know, I think his appearance on CNN and Black America Too. Many people were looking forward to part two of Soledad O'Brien and CNN's documentary investigating what it means to be African-American today. And he started it off with the 15-minute live interview with Soledad O'Brien. And it was surprising because many people think that Professor Gates is a historian. He's not. He's a literary critic. And so it was surprising his response. He was stunned that this could happen to him. But he was stunned that this could happen in the United States of America, especially given all of the narratives that would take place on CNN and Black America Too. And I think that then he began to start losing some support within the African American community because this police racial profiling, police brutality are serious issues. And the challenge for many African Americans with President Obama is that he was so silent throughout the campaign about issues of race, particularly around Jenna 6. So the one moment that you speak about race after an extraordinary appearance in front of the NAACP,
well, that's
extraordinary
what I wanted to say.
Appearance. I mean, it's about Professor
that's what we were
Gates
talking about.
And an incident that everyone didn't fully know the facts.
But does this squander that sense of having settled questions or deeply and emotionally dealt with questions on race at the NAACP convention? Does that squander that we're like having a beer in the backyard?
Well, I think any conversation about race is an important conversation. I just think that this has now lapsed into a photo op. And, you know, is this going to be neatly packaged with the weekly news?
Right.
And for many African-Americans who have had children who've been murdered by police officers, like the gentleman in Oakland who was murdered by the police, it's, you know, their lives have to go on. It's not about a photo op and a beer, a red stripe, a blue moon.
Well, and Robert Gibbs at the White House said it right at the top of the segment.
Right at the top.
It is going to be a photo op. I wonder if that contributes to any sense that something constructive can happen here.
Sure. Let's bring in Sheila Heen, author of Difficult Conversations and a lecture on negotiations at Harvard Law School, to weigh in. Sheila, thanks for joining us.
Well, hello.
Hello. So we're talking about this millennial brew, the White House, in watching, they're calling it the audacity of hop. Is there really an opportunity here for real reconciliation, or is it just really a photo op?
Well, that's one of the challenges in this case, which is I think there is opportunity for reconciliation if they can get a real conversation going, but doing so under the shadow of the media, you know, is hard because it's really two negotiations going on at once. They're obviously negotiating with each other and with the president as the mediator, by the way. But really, a lot of what's going on is that they're negotiating their own reputations in the broader community. You know, even that night there was an audience, and whenever there's an audience, issues of identity and reactivity and defensiveness, you know, go way up.
Well, that's interesting that you say that President Obama is the mediator. Isn't he actually one of the antagonists, given the press conference last week when he said that the officers had acted stupidly?
Well, that's one of his challenges, which is that as the mediator, of course, as someone who's trying to convene a conversation, the parties want to know, are you neutral? And I think he not intentionally actually tipped his hand in a way that at least the perception is that he's not necessarily neutral. And whether or not he is, which I actually think is one of his greatest gifts, he's really pointing out what's legitimate about two sides to a conflict.
But
in this case, you know, he tipped his hand in a way that changes the perception.
But I got to tell you, I'm really skeptical about how much reconciliation can happen when you're sitting there in front of the president of the United States, leader of the free world. What are you really going to say to his face? I mean, I would show up for this invitation if he had Charlie Manson waiting in the waiting room. I mean,
well,
it's just
such
an honor.
I've got to disagree with you there, Charles Manson.
Well, I mean, you know, what kind of sincerity can we expect when basically if the president beckons, you come?
Right. It's a brouhaha.
Yeah.
Well, Sheila, I mean, I guess what Amy's question is, if there is reconciliation even between these three guys, does it have any relevance to any sort of broader racial reconciliation out in the country? Sheila?
Well, that I think is one of the interesting things, which is I do think that there's an opportunity here. It's just that there's a couple of big hurdles to get there. In other words, if they can actually prepare for this conversation, and I mean Crowley and Gates, in a way that sets them up to be constructive, then there's actually an opportunity for the three of them to do something interesting together. But, you know, it's kind of a long road to get there.
I just want to interject that, you know, when President Clinton was in office, he convened a conversation about race with the esteemed Dr. John Hope Franklin as the moderator, and the media laughed at it. I mean, people looked at it as quite cynical. This was a real probative look at the African-American narrative, our place in American history. That would have made it really good. our contribution to the world. And people cynically laughed at that attempt to do that. This notion of Skip Gates and Crowley reconciling, I didn't understand they had a fallout over something personal, you know, and that, you know, given all the important issues that are taking place right now, like health care and other issues and unemployment, you know, is this the very best way for the president to spend his time?
But I keep circling back, and Sheila, maybe you can answer this. How do you have a candid discussion when the mediator is someone of such dazzling celebrity and power? Do you really have, I mean, will either Crowley or Skip Gates feel like they can be candid?
Well, I think it depends on how they negotiate with themselves ahead of time. In other words, you know, race makes this a particularly hot issue. But I think everybody listening can identify with a situation where you walk into a conversation with someone, you don't expect it to escalate, you don't expect it to be a difficult conversation, and suddenly it's 15 minutes later, the thing has escalated beyond anything you intended. I don't think either Crowley or Gates that evening wanted to be in the center of a media firestorm.
Right, right. But
the
particular
trigger for it is related to race, because Skip Gates doesn't know that asking for ID is a standard procedure. I've lived in Cambridge for 10 years. I've had my house robbed. When the cops came, they asked me for ID.
Well, certainly the cast of characters complicates the idea that this is some sort of casual discussion between the three pals. Sheila Heen is author of Difficult Conversations, a lecturer on negotiations at Harvard Law School, and Patrick Henry Bass, senior editor at Essence Magazine. Thanks to you both. I think Skip Gates will be candid with the president. Harvard professor, he's not going to pull any punches.
That's true.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Tech Talk on The Takeaway. Must be Thursday.
Tech Talk.
Takeaway Tech Talk on Thursday.
That's
right. Sam Grobart is here, personal technology editor for The New York Times. And down in Baltimore at PRI member station WEAA in Baltimore is Peter Wehner, who's a contributing technology writer for The New York Times and also author of Translucent Databases. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Good morning, Sam. Now, in Baltimore, they are beginning to wire their city for all kinds of sophisticated, ubiquitous wireless all throughout the city. Sam, first of all, it seems that the United States is way behind in this process, that there are many countries in the world where it's impossible to escape wireless technology, and that actually to step outside of a wireless network is to feel naked in places like South Korea. First of all, why are we so far behind, Sam?
Well, John, I think we're probably behind in the sense that we are behind because WiMAX is a new technology based on two reasons, geography and culture. Countries such as South Korea, Japan, Israel, fairly small countries, pretty easy to get them covered with a good wireless situation. And then you also have countries that are not averse to technology. Again, South Korea, Japan, Israel have robust technology industries, and it's part of their culture to kind of embrace new tech.
You know, and there is a really interesting cultural question. In Japan, wireless technology and all kinds of aspects of cell phone functionality are so ubiquitous that it's actually made Japanese cell phones almost impossible to sell. The Japanese look at a cell phone and they want it to actually make toast.
Right.
The rest of us look at a Japanese cell phone and go, get that away from me. It scares me. I mean, it's really changed the way the entire culture views technology. Right, Sam?
It has. And we wrote about the Japanese cell phone market about a week ago where we talked about it being a Galapagos syndrome, highly evolved species that don't exist anywhere else in the world. That's sort of what the cell phones are like over there.
All right, so Peter Wehmer, what evolution is likely to take place down there in Baltimore as WiMAX technology is wired into the culture of the city of Baltimore, Peter?
I think people are going to discover all kinds of things they can do with their laptops when they're out and around. Because the one thing, I mean, I was just amazed. I was at lunch and, you know, I was talking to someone. We popped open the laptop and we were able to get 6 megabits per second down. Which is a lot of bandwidth, and that's more than a lot of people have in their house.
Which means you could download like a hologram of Abraham Lincoln or something like right there?
Well, you know, we could do that. It turns out we were just talking about software, so we were able to pull something down pretty quickly. But, you know, these open up lots of different opportunities, and you're using this with your laptop, so it's a very open platform. And you can do practically anything. So VoIP is very easy to do over
voice over internet protocol. It's like Skype phones, that sort of thing.
That's right. Yeah, right. Like a Skype phone, or there's certainly all the different video you can get. And so all of a sudden your laptop becomes kind of this TV that can access anything anytime you want. And that's kind of a neat feature. And there, you know, it's hard to know what people are going to do with the rest of the opportunity, but I'm sure they're going to be scientists who are wiring up houses to do different things. And, you know, there are lots of different opportunities when you have this kind of cloud covering a city.
Peter, that's fascinating. This is Amy Holmes. I'm going to try to jump into all this techie talk. So does this mean that you, if you're just sitting in a park, you can open up your laptop and go online in Baltimore?
Yeah, right. I don't want to say that it covers the entire city because it doesn't, but it covers most of the city. And you can pop open the laptop, and not only can you go online, but you can go online with a very fast connection, you know, something that's as fast as many cable modems and actually kind of faster than most DSL lines I've found.
All right, so Peter Wehner and Sam Grobart, you both write for the New York Times about technology. The issue here, it seems to me, Sam, is that suddenly the park or the street corner is no different than your living room in terms of your ability to access media, software, and have full functioning communication with anyone in the world. Right, Sam?
That's right. And that's probably for many people as much a curse as a blessing, similar to allowing, wireless access in airplanes. You are now available to be reached by, say, your boss. You know, it's no longer, oh, I was walking in between appointments. I didn't get your email. No, no, you got my email. I know you did because we have WiMAX, and why didn't you check your laptop and things like that?
Well, but Peter Wehner, let's get back to the evolution question. You know, we've seen what users have done to drive the changes in cell phones and connectivity in South Korea. You know, teenage girls being very, very important first adopters in South Korea. Same in Japan. What's likely to happen, do you think, in the United States when we cross some critical threshold in a city where everybody can see everybody else through their, you know, Wi-Fi laptop webcams?
You know, the one thing, I mean, that always comes to my mind is the question of what's going to happen with webcams and video chat. Because right now, once you have this WiMAX in Baltimore, it's very easy for me to pop up my laptop and just start a really nice high-resolution video chat with anybody I want to because the bandwidth is there and I can do it on the street corner the same way I would pop open a cell phone. And you know, the video phones have been something that have been promised to us for 40, 50 years from all the different world fairs and things like that. And it may not be something that the culture is ready for, but I'm going to see. It's going to be interesting to see how it evolves because I know, like, a number of people in business really like to negotiate face-to-face. And so all of a sudden, you know, you're not going to be able to dodge things as easily with a cell phone if people insist on firing up a video chat. And your boss isn't going to be able to say, you know, why can't you, you know, turn on the camera?
Right. I'm going into the tunnel.
So, Peter, yeah, here's exactly. Just a fairly basic question. Why Baltimore? Why this particular city?
You know, I'm not sure exactly what happened in the boardroom when they made these decisions, but my guess is that there are several factors. One, a lot of people say that Baltimore is demographically very, very average. So it has a mixture of poor, a mixture of rich. It has a mixture of all these different things. And I think a lot of America thinks of Baltimore because they see the TV show The Wire. But really, it's got a huge educational foundation here. I mean, Johns Hopkins is an amazing juggernaut. It's got a beautiful, you know, downtown. And it has a wide range of financial businesses. So it really is kind of a microcosm of America, and I suspect that may be why they started it.
And it's been a test market for years. Peter Wehner, contributing technology writer for The New York Times and author of Translucent Databases. Good luck down there in Baltimore. Sam Grobart, before we go, how much is this infrastructure going to cost nationally? Any idea?
Well, it has been part of the stimulus bill, particularly to build out in rural areas, and we're dealing in the billions of dollars.
All right.
So it'll be determined later.
Well, coming to a neighborhood near you, WiMAX Technology, part of our conversation on Tech Thursday here at The Takeaway. Sam Grobart, personal technology editor for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks for being with us again. And here's some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Health officials are recommending the first H1N1 vaccines be given to pregnant women, healthcare workers, and children older than 6 months. 120 million doses are expected to be ready by October.
Sounds like that Titanic, pregnant women and children first. I don't know.
Yes,
it
makes
me nervous.
Yeah. Federal agents swept across the country yesterday, arresting some 30 people in a Medicare fraud bust. Here's Justice Department spokesman Laura Sweeney.
We allege that they submitted more than $16 million in false claims to the Medicare program, and this is part of a larger, what we are calling the HEAT initiative.
The bust is the third major Medicare fraud sweep since May.
So in the U.S., officials in Des Moines, Iowa, say too many pedestrians are being struck by buses making left turns. So get this, bus drivers in downtown will now follow routes that only make right-hand turns. Coming up in North Carolina, alleged terrorist Daniel Patrick Boyd is described as the guy next door. What does it mean to track homegrown terrorists? Coming up.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes, joining me all week. And we've both been following this healthcare debate. And you may recall when President Obama said this last June in a meeting with the American Medical Association.
McAllen, Texas is spending twice as much as El Paso County. Twice as much. Not because people in McAllen, Texas are sicker, than they are in El Paso. Not because they're getting better care or getting better outcomes. It's simply because they're using more treatments.
Using more treatments in McAllen, Texas. There's quite a business model there. It got some folks over at the New York Times thinking, so if they're spending more money on health care in McAllen, Texas, what else are they spending on? As we get involved in this debate on healthcare in Washington, D.C. And it turns out that one hospital in McAllen, Texas, is one of the largest sources of campaign contributions to Senate Democrats. The Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee collected nearly, can you guess how much?
I think almost half a million dollars.
Half a million, that's right. And that's just for the Senate candidates. $500,000 at a reception here on March 30th, mostly from physicians and other affiliated with a single hospital called Doctors Hospital. Not an ordinary place. National correspondent for the New York Times, Kevin Sack, broke the story of these campaign contributions. He joins us from Atlanta. So, Kevin, what's at stake here? I mean, the hospital is a huge campaign contributor. It's a big corporation. They're clearly stakeholders. But what outcome do you think they want out of Washington?
Well, they've obviously got a whole lot of different types of interests in health reform, as any hospital would. But this hospital has a particular narrow interest because it's one of about 230 physician-owned hospitals in the country. About 82% of total investment in the hospital is from doctors, many of whom obviously work at the hospital as well. And what they're trying to do is soften language in the health reform bill that would restrict the ability of new physician-owned hospitals to be created, and more importantly, for their purposes, would restrict the ability of existing physician-owned hospitals to grow.
All right, well, quickly, everything that they're doing is legal, right?
Correct, as far as we know.
All right, so let's just clear that up. And then is there any sense that the track record on healthcare of this hospital is an example worthy of replicating elsewhere in the United States?
Well, it's a good hospital, as far as I can tell. It's brand spanking new. It's about 6 years old as a hospital. It's had incredibly rapid growth. It's grown from about 30 beds to over 500 beds in 6 years. It's in a very rapidly growing part of the country, in a very underserved part of the country. And they have brought many services to that area that had not existed before, high-tech imaging and robotic surgery and things like that.
Well, they have enough cash on hand to be contributors to the tune of $500,000 to the Senate Democratic Campaign Committee. Kevin Sack, just a piece of the story in the healthcare debate. Great story broken in the New York Times. He's the national correspondent for the New York Times speaking to us from Atlanta. Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks for having me.
Amy?
So we have the North Carolina terrorism gang story that is just unfolding. New details every day. Federal authorities are looking for a suspected eighth member of this gang.
Yeah, they were freaking out in North Carolina yesterday. We were talking to them.
Yeah, that he's in Pakistan. And we were talking to folks yesterday. You know, neighbors just can't believe that Daniel Boyd, this 39-year-old drywaller, could be involved in jihad. Well, with us here today is Mitch Silber, Director of Intelligence Analysis for the New York Police Department, to help us, you know, understand what's going on. Mitch, you have a tough and fascinating job. Can you tell our listeners what you do every day to protect New York City from attack?
Sure. Well, good morning. My responsibility is to oversee the analysis part of all of the intelligence investigations that the NYPD is doing. And I oversee a group of about two dozen talented civilian and uniformed analysts, as well as our cyber internet team.
And it's a global effort, correct?
Yeah, absolutely. We have personnel posted in 11 different posts around the world, ranging from the UK to Abu Dhabi to Singapore, and we're constantly trying to understand trends overseas and look at the and ask the New York questions once we hear what's going on overseas.
You better get a team to North Carolina, huh?
No kidding. So when we woke up to, you know, the picture of Daniel Boyd, for a lot of Americans, it was just totally shocking, totally surprising. Is this a game changer for you in terms of profiling potential terrorist suspects?
I think when we saw North Carolina, we felt validated because we put out a study in 2007 called Radicalization in the West. And what that really talked about, the fact that a lot of these individuals who either aspire to be al-Qaeda or actually end up linking up to al-Qaeda, like the Patchogue jihadist Bryant Neal-Vinyas, were actually radicalized in the West, not in a madrasa in Pakistan. And that means that the onus is on Western law enforcement for detection and ultimately disruption.
So what is it about this all-American guy, Daniel Boyd, for you that raises red flags specifically?
Well, you know, he's a part of a number of people who we would qualify as unremarkable. There's nothing in their background at first that makes them someone who you'd think you'd go this route. But ultimately, there are a series of behaviors and behaviors that we talked about in this report that were signposts or red flags that he was going down this road. For example, in the indictment that says he and his followers, the Raleigh Seven, they left the mosque they were at. They got into some type of conflict with the imam. And frankly, we've seen that pattern before because usually the religious leader isn't extreme enough.
So that says radicalization to you.
That says that the message they're getting at what might be a moderate location isn't extreme enough for them, and they go to a private location. Yes, that says radicalization, and it's a big red flag for us.
What about his trips overseas? I mean, just because he, you know, goes to the Middle East doesn't necessarily mean he's going there to train. How do you view that?
Well, I'd say that would probably be one of the other very bright red flags. When we see people looking to travel to international hot zones, Pakistan, Somalia, Iraq, places where there's an ongoing military conflict, Gaza, that is a red flag. And if you put these two together, what might be benign behaviors, suddenly you've got a pattern that we've seen repeat itself.
Well, let me push back just a little bit on that. I mean, it's not as though if my neighbors who are Muslims, right, and you have Muslim neighbors, we both do, were to come to me and say, we're going on vacation, we're going to Gaza and Israel, we're going to check out Pakistan, that I'm supposed to give you a call all of a sudden?
Yeah, it's tricky because we're dealing with nuanced behaviors, behaviors that are surely protected by the Constitution. But really what it is you're looking at a cluster of behaviors, a series of behaviors that in and of themselves are benign. But really when you start to map these together, the rejecting the moderate message, the going out doing military training in the countryside, and then the travel overseas, now you've got a pattern.
So very quickly for our listeners, what should we be looking for? What are some, top three things that might signal that we have a neighbor next door who might be involved in jihad?
Frankly, it's very difficult for the neighbor next door to determine it. They're really so...
Leave it to the professionals, I guess.
In a sense, yes.
Well, I guess that's our takeaway for this. Thank you, Mitch Silber, Director of Intelligence Analysis for the New York Police Department.
It's complex, that's for sure. All day we are asking you to weigh in on something else. Tonight, President Obama, right, Skip Gates, Jim Crowley get together for a beer. Will a drink solve the problem? And when have you solved an argument over a brew?
When has beer helped? Beer brings all people together. It's a wonderful thing. And I have never known the problem that couldn't be solved by sitting down with someone and having a beer.
Or created. Problems created, problems solved. Give us your take at 8778-MY-TAKE or send us an email to thetakeaway.org. Coming up, news you can use about H1N1 virus. It's hard to find.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And John Line, the BBC's Tehran correspondent, would normally be on the streets of that city observing what's going on there. Breaking news this morning out of Tehran. He's at the BBC's Bush House for reasons we don't have to get into, but relate to just the political sensitivity of the aftermath of the election in Iran. Good morning, John Line. Let's talk about what we're seeing on the streets of Tehran. Reports that the main opposition leader, Mir Hussein Mousavi, has been stopped from attending a memorial service to those who died in the country following the disputed presidential election. This is the politics of mourning in Iran this morning. John Line?
That's right. A very sensitive issue with these 40-day mourning ceremonies, the Arbaeen, because these happened a lot in the 1979 Islamic Revolution and were really a focus for political protests. So the government is very nervous about them now. Once again, maybe they could be turfed out of office through the same route. What happened today is that the opposition asked for permission to hold a large ceremony in the center of Tehran for all of those killed since the election. They were refused permission. So instead, there's a ceremony just at the graveside of Neda Akhosultan, this beautiful young woman who was killed 40 days ago. And the opposition leadership announced that they were going to go there, including Mir Hussein Mousavi. He turned up there today. It seems that the police turned him away. They were there in force, and they packed him back to his car. And we're just getting reports also that another of the opposition candidates, Mehdi Karoubi, has also turned up, but he's been surrounded by police, and they in turn have been had stones thrown at them by opposition protesters. So it sounds like quite a lively event going on there.
Well, we want to give you a sense that this is more than just a delicate dance here. These are passionate voices of people who desperately want to participate in these events. Here's one named Akbar, who spoke to BBC news gatherers in Tehran.
I think it's only decent to do this for the people who've given up their lives and sacrificed themselves. So essentially, I think this is a matter of honor.
And that matter of honor is going to drive people into the streets, John Line, right?
Well, we've seen even, I think opposition protesters know what's waiting for them when they go out there. Now they're going to be met with these besieging militiamen from the government and riot police with at best sticks and clubs and batons and possibly at worst gunfire. And still the opposition are going out there, not perhaps in the millions that they were immediately after the election, but they're persistently going out there. The passions have not in any way gone away.
And the government really on a number of fronts have taken a hard line here. We had a story in the New York Times yesterday about prison abuse among people who were arrested in the aftermath of the election. We've also had stories out of Iran of these coercive confessions that are all over the media in Iran. The risks are high for ordinary people even getting involved in this at all, right, John?
Well, they're certainly high for people getting involved and for people who are arrested. And there have been reports of numbers of people killed in prison, killed during demonstrations, and certainly badly beaten up. Many, many reports of ill treatment in prisons. But, of course, this is also damaging the government now because it's been the focus of anger against the government, even from former government supporters inside the parliament, hardline conservatives. So it has damaged the government. President Ahmadinejad has felt forced to announce the release of most of those detained after the election, though they're also threatening to put at least 20 of them on trial, perhaps using some of these confessions, however obtained.
John Lyon, BBC Tehran correspondent, watching the situation in Tehran from BBC's Bush House in London. Thank you, John. So the question really there, Amy, is are the tensions rising or are they subsiding? And we really don't know the answer.
Right. Will it actually inflame passions on the street?
Yeah, much more to watch.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes here with John Hockenberry. Who's first in line to get a vaccine for the H1N1 virus and who's last? That's the issue coming up later. But first, let's get more of the morning's top news stories, John.
Well, we got new jobless numbers out just this hour. 584,000 Americans filed new unemployment claims last week, and that's higher than expected. We'll see if it moves the markets.
They won't have time to pass a bill, but congressional Democrats hope to get health care legislation passed committees before the August recess. A House committee vote could come as early as today. A judge will decide whether a young Guantanamo Bay detainee will go home to Afghanistan or face prosecution in the U.S. The prisoner is accused of a grenade attack on American troops, but the judge has questioned the case against him. Arguments are today.
The Taliban is stepping into next month's presidential election in Afghanistan. Well, they're not running a candidate, but they are telling a leading Taliban website Afghans should boycott the voting, but they are at least participating in the political process. We're following all these stories and more this morning.
A CDC advisory panel recommended yesterday that pregnant women get first priority for an H1N1 flu vaccine. That vaccine may be available as early as September. John, we understand this has some salience and relevance to your life.
Well, it's
right?
kind of like we won the lottery in our family. My wife is expecting her due date is early December. So for the last 2 months, we've been trying desperately to get a straight answer as to what the risks of a vaccine are, what the risks of flu are, and what the risk of something like Tamiflu is. And I have to say, it's been very difficult getting any sort of straight answers. I mean, last night we really just talked about the hand washing at the table.
Indeed, we have Dr. Richard Wenzel, chairman of the Department of Internal Medicine at Virginia Commonwealth University, to try to sort through all of these issues. Dr. Wenzel, thanks for joining us.
That's a pleasure.
So H1N1 is dominating the headlines right now, but I want to know, how big of a risk is it really? We went through bird flu. We went through West Nile virus. Is this different?
This may be different. My perspective is that I was in down in Mexico during the heat of their epidemic in the first couple of days in May. I just returned from a number of countries in Latin America. And let me give you an example of pregnancy. In Brazil, my infectious disease colleagues say they think pregnancy is the number one cause for why they're seeing their patients who need ICU care. In Colombia, I met with the Ministry of Health. They're reporting 7 deaths in adults. One of the 7 was in a pregnant woman. But the most compelling data from Argentina, where in the Buenos Aires area, there were 85 deaths, about half of what the total country sees. 1 in 4 were in pregnant women. So it has my attention.
You're ruining my day.
Well, yes, I know.
Let's bring in 2 more voices to the discussion. We have Layla Laniado, who's 5 months pregnant. She joins us from Atlanta, Georgia. And also Dr. Laura Riley, an obstetrician with Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. Welcome, ladies. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Thank
so, Layla, you're dealing with this really tough, difficult decision right now. What are you going to do?
I would love to get that vaccine. In fact, I have family in Argentina, and they're telling me the same things as doctor is speaking about. In fact, the government advised pregnant women to stay home for a while. So I'm hoping the vaccine is going to be available before I'm there.
Dr. Riley, do you advise that to your patients to go and get this vaccine?
I will when it becomes available. I mean, I think that, you know, most pregnant women are going to ask the question, is the vaccine safe?
Right.
And I think that at this point, we don't know, but there's no reason to suspect that it'll be unsafe. But I think what's more important is that it's very clear, both as you just heard, that in South America, clearly pregnant women are at greatest risk. But also, I think the CDC here has shown that pregnant women here who get H1N1 are, you know, very likely to get severe pneumonia or some other respiratory, you know, infection that requires them to be in an intensive care unit or even die. In which case, you know, at that point, if the risk of the illness is tremendous, I think it's worth taking whatever that very small risk of the vaccination is.
So, Dr. Riley, what about this news we're hearing that it could cause schizophrenia in the baby? What do you know about that?
I think at this point we don't know much about that. I think it's probably, my guess is, unlikely. You're going to need to vaccinate a huge population to really see if that's a real association. You know, I think you have to be careful about these associations in general. You know, schizophrenia, it's probably many factors that cause a child to be schizophrenic, and I am very skeptical that you'll be
right.
able to pin it on one small thing like, you know, the influenza vaccine as opposed to, you know, genetics and, you know, car exhaust.
Right. Well, let me just lay out a short list of risks. And if you could prioritize them for me, Dr. Richard Wenzel and Laura Riley as well. And I want to hear from Layla before we go. I mean, it sounds like the biggest risk is respiratory problems in the mother if she becomes infected with the flu. What about the risk of the flu's impact on a fetus? And is that varied between early term and late term? And finally, the risk of the vaccine. Dr. Richard Wenzel?
Well, we really don't know much about the vaccine, your last question. It has to be tested. Most of the time, influenza vaccine is safe. We had one unfortunate example in 1976, so-called swine flu at that point, a totally different virus than what we're seeing now. And that vaccine had a high rate of a neuropathy called Guillain-Barré syndrome. There's no reason to suspect it'll happen here, but people are going to be watching that very carefully.
Dr. Wenzel, I understand that Britain is going so far as to suggest women put off getting pregnant after past the flu season. Do you think that that's extreme?
Well, it's asking a lot of people, I think, to do that. If we have a safe vaccine, then obviously that will preclude that need. But that's a very dramatic example of what to do.
It's dramatic, and it's not a real reasonable
request,
especially in the U.S., where 50% of pregnancies are unplanned.
Yeah, I don't think it's reasonable, but I'd like to ask Dr. Riley what she thinks.
Well, it sounds like I want to hear from Layla Laniado, Atlanta resident, 5 months pregnant. You and my wife are just going to roll the dice, it sounds like, Layla.
I know. We tried so hard. You know, we went through fertility treatments. It's something we can choose when it happens. You know, I'm doing January. Would love to get this vaccine, you know, if I can.
And Layla, you know, we're hearing all this conflicting information. Do you feel pretty confident then about your options?
No, I would take the risk if this vaccine is available. I've seen what happens to people that get it, so I don't want to be one of them.
Well, we want our listeners, if they're facing the same situation, to call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or give us some sense of the details and the options that you are evaluating at MyTake at thetakeaway.org. Dr. Laura Riley, if you are in this situation and you want to get yourself in the front of the line, what steps can you take now to ensure that you're not going to be left out in the cold, either in terms of Tamiflu availability or vaccine availability?
I think it's clear that the CDC has suggested pregnant women be at the top of the list. So I think what pregnant women need to do is go into their obstetricians or their primary care physicians and say, I'm pregnant, I want the vaccine, I understand that there are some, you know, safety issues potentially, but I also recognize that getting the flu in this situation could be far worse. So I think they just need to speak up and advocate for themselves.
Well, that's great advice. And anything you would add to that, Dr. Wenzel?
No, I think that's very good advice. The other thing you might think about is, and I think women should check with their obstetricians, if you're exposed to H1N1 and you are pregnant, there is a drug, Tamiflu, also Tamivir, that's excellent as a prophylactic or preventive agent. Whether or not how safe it is in pregnancy is a little unclear to me.
I think as an obstetrician, having gone through this, you know, spring issue with H1N1 and used a lot of the Tamiflu, I mean, I think we feel that it is certainly safe enough and a good enough preventive measure that it is well worth getting yourself into your PCP or obstetrician's office if, in fact, you've been exposed. And certainly, if you have any symptoms, even remotely close to the flu, it's important to go in early in the process and not wait and sit at home and think it's just a cold
right.
and it's going to go away.
Right.
Because that has been what has gotten us into trouble before. Women come in and are so incredibly sick, we can't turn it around.
Well, I want to thank our guests, Dr. Laura Riley, OBGYN of Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston, Dr. Richard Wenzel, epidemiologist and chairman at Virginia Commonwealth University, and Layla Laniato for joining us from Atlanta. Thank you.
On a lighter note, we're interested in your take on the meeting later today between Skip Gates, Jim Crowley, and President Obama. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us an email. And here's your take.
Any conversation about race is an important conversation. I just think that this has now lapsed into a photo, and it's not about a photo op in a beer, a red stripe, or blue moon.
That's right. Essence Magazine's Patrick Henry Basson, our friend here at The Takeaway. You can go to the website and hear a blog post from Sheila Heen, who we also talk with. She's the author of Difficult Conversations. She's written a post on our website at thetakeaway.org.
I'm Amy Holmes.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Another day, another town meeting on healthcare.
We've cut the cost of the bill substantially.
It's trouble in town, you know that.
We've delayed a floor vote until September, so members have time to read it.
It's trouble in town, you know that.
We have protected small businesses. And finally,
conservative Blue Dog Democrats say they've cut a deal on health care reform in the House. Does it gut the Obama vision? And is Washington running out of time? A new New York Times poll says confidence in Obama on health care is slipping.
Troubles everywhere you go. Troubles after you.
Town meeting troubles on The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
trouble. That starts with T, and that's what we start with this morning. It's Thursday, July 30th. I'm John Hockenberry. Amy Holmes is with us all week, former Senate speechwriter, political analyst. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning.
On the show today, more from the healthcare debate, as well as new findings on how our bodies burn fat. We'll also visit a U.S. Army base in the deep sands of Afghanistan. The president has a beer tonight with the white cop and the African-American scholar who ignited a national conversation. And what are people in bars saying about all this? We'll have a listen to that, a great conversation. But on healthcare, let's put the question to Todd Zwillick, takeaway correspondent and our contributor in Washington, D.C. Todd, it appears that the progressives are suddenly out of luck. If this deal holds with the conservative Blue Dog Democrats, there's no progressive national healthcare vision left, right?
Well, it seems to be slipping. It's a little early to say, John, that progressives are out of luck because this bill has a ways to go. All of the healthcare news that we heard yesterday, I'm going to say that that they're not near the goal line. They were on the 48-yard line, if I must use a football metaphor. They got 2 yards for the first down, so they're still on the 50-yard line. But the progressives probably don't like what they're seeing in the Senate.
Well, we'll think of another metaphor for you, Todd. All the play-by-play from...
Go, go, Todd Zwillick!
Todd Zwillick, the Takeaway's Washington correspondent. That conversation continues later. First, everything you need to know in the news, in the headlines, fresh numbers on the job market. New claims for unemployment benefits were up more than expected last week. 580,000 people filed for the jobless benefits. And Congress is acting fast to make sure the federal aid that helps pay for those benefit checks doesn't run out while it's on recess in August. Emergency legislation is passed. The House goes on to the Senate.
Pregnant women, healthcare workers, and children older than 6 months should be first in line for H1N1 flu vaccine. That's what health officials are recommending. Vaccine trials are going on now. The case of a young Guantanamo Bay detainee who's been held for more than 6 years is back before a federal judge today. He's accused of attacking two U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. The judge hears arguments on whether he should be released or face criminal charges right here in the United States.
Fresh concerns about how to finance the growing federal deficit. Demand was low at a Treasury auction for five-year debt yesterday. The Treasury sold just $39 billion. They wanted more. It could affect interest rates. The Dow opens this hour at 90.71. The S&P starts trading at 9.75. Suggests a positive opening. So the president, Skip Gates, and Crowley have a beer. What do you think about that?
Hey, my name's Nick. I'm calling from West Bloomfield, Michigan. And a beer settles everything, whether, you know, you have a dispute of maybe discussing sports stats between a friend or, you know, a problem with your roommate. It's always settled with one thing, and that's I'll buy you a pint of beer.
We'll take it to the experts later in the show, but call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at KnightFoundation.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway.
I'm Amy Holmes, in all week with John Hockenberry. So, John, this healthcare debate has more twists and turns than a small intestine. How's that for a metaphor?
Ooh. Let's go to the upper GI of Washington now for a live report.
Fortunately, we have Todd Zwillick here bringing you back, our Washington correspondent, to sort all of this out. Todd, what's the very latest with the healthcare debate? Let's start with the Senate.
I don't know how I feel about your metaphor, Amy. All right, so let's get started right in the Senate. Deals announced all over Capitol Hill yesterday, being trumpeted by Democrats who really want to show some progress before the August break here. Don't forget, the president had said he wanted to vote on all of this before August 7th, and none of that's going to happen. So Democrats are now striving to show some progress as members head home for the summer break. First in the Senate, Max Baucus came out yesterday and announced what he said were some very positive CBO scores on this deal that group of three Republicans and three Democrats has been working on
and
in
Todd,
the Senate.
The CBO has not been their friend up to this point.
You're right. For the most part, they have not been their friend. There have been a lot of disappointments on these CBO scores. How much is all this going to cost to pay for? Baucus comes out yesterday and says, well, the deal we have now is down to $900 billion from a trillion. Originally, it was $1.5 trillion on some of the deals they were talking about months ago. So now they're well under $1 trillion, which is an important psychological point for the cost of this bill. Not only $900 billion over 10 years covers 95% of Americans, he said, and by the last year 2019, the 10-year budget window would actually start to reduce the deficit. That's a cut, meaning it would potentially meet the president's demand that this start to bend the cost curve. So that was good news in the Senate. Baucus saying it was great news. Even a couple of Republicans saying we're on the verge of a deal. But then other Republicans saying, no. There's no deal yet. We're not even close to a deal. Nobody get excited. This is no deal. So in the morning, you had these claims of sort of, we're close to victory. We have a deal. And then a lot of people pulling this back and saying, not so fast.
Gotcha. Let's move across the dome to the House side. What are we hearing there?
Okay, it's actually a very similar dynamic. A deal announced that then by the end of the day got walked back. Over on the House side, this has been a debate amongst Democrats. Henry Waxman, who's the chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee, as we've reported on previous days, is trying to get the bill just through his committee, and he had to make a deal with a small group of conservative Blue Dog Democrats. Yesterday, he got that deal. Mike Ross is a congressman from Arkansas. He's the head of the Blue Dogs on this health care negotiation. He came out of the room and talked to reporters, and here's what he said about the deal he got with Waxman.
We've delayed a floor vote until September, so members have time to read it and talk to their constituents about it during August. We have protected small businesses. And finally, we ensure that any public option is on a level playing field, but we'll require the public option plans to negotiate just like private insurance companies do directly with providers for a network and for rates.
So Mike Ross is happy because this deal could get the bill just through the Energy and Commerce Committee. But those things he was talking about, we've got the public option on a level playing field now. Well, progressives, and they've got big numbers in the House, they're furious over this. They have said over and over, we will not vote for a bill that does not have a strong and robust public option. We're not signing on to this. In fact, if this deal comes to the floor, we might vote against it. And so Waxman's deal was supposed to make his markup, his processing of the bill, go through yesterday. And by the time everyone got to the room for the markup, because there was a deal, it was the liberals who said, no markup. We're going to vote against it. So they're going to try again today. Again, you announce success and then things get ratcheted back by the end of the day. It's all very tenuous.
Twisty and turny, as I said at the top of this interview, a metaphor you didn't like, but thank you, Todd.
My pleasure.
For giving us this information. That was Todd Zwillick, our Takeaway Washington correspondent.
And joining us now is one of those alleged progressives, Congressman Anthony Weiner, Congressman of New York's 9th District. He joins us from his office in Washington. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure. Good morning.
You know, I have to say, Congressman Weiner, that Rahm Emanuel sits down with the conservative Blue Dogs. All of a sudden, hundreds of billions of dollars go out the window. Can you get a meeting with Rahm Emanuel on your mission for health care reform?
Well, I think he's going to have to pay attention to us. There are a lot of people in the House who feel that we're missing a great opportunity. You know, the deals that were struck yesterday in the House and Senate essentially transferred money from working people and subsidies that we put in the bill for people to be able to afford health care to insurance companies. There's really no other way to interpret it, and it might be good to get a deal out of this committee or that committee, but the question is whether it's the way we want to extend health care and whether this is the structure that we should be operating on.
Well, it doesn't sound like a question to me. Based on what happened yesterday, it sounds like your president has abandoned you, Congressman Weiner.
Well, I don't take it so personally as you do, John, but it's clear that we are trying to go through this legislative process with a combination of compromises, and to some degree we're losing sight of what we want to accomplish here. Look, many of us believe, and I'm going to have an opportunity to test this in the Energy and Commerce Committee today or tomorrow, many of us believe that fundamentally what we're doing is we're stacking health care on the fragile foundation of the private insurance model, which is sapping enormous amount of money from healthcare and putting it to for-profit companies that, frankly, if we were going to create a healthcare plan from scratch, we probably wouldn't even think of including. And every time we twist and contort ourselves to try to satisfy insurance companies' concerns, I think we get further away from the ideal, which is affordable healthcare for all Americans.
All right. So you say if this bill doesn't seriously scrap or modify the private insurance model, it's a deal breaker for you, or you have serious questions about it. What do you make of the price tag dominating the debate? The $1.5 trillion, $1 trillion, $900 billion. Does that make you nervous?
Well, the problem here, and this is a problem with the national debate, and to some degree, I hold the president responsible. You know, the question is the overall cost of the bill, what it's going to cost us in taxes, what it's going to cost us in the price of products, what it's going to cost us for health care, saves Americans enormous amounts of money. Yes, what we're doing is we're saying that we're going to have a larger federal role in providing people with health care, but that means we're going to pay lower taxes locally. If we do this right, that means we pay a lower premium for our insurance. If we do it right, it means a product, products that we buy are going to be less expensive. A lot of the problem with this debate is we're only looking at the cost of setting up the program and not looking at the savings. I'll give you one example. I live in a city in New York City We spend $3 billion every single year providing care and insurance for the uninsured who walk into our hospital emergency rooms. Well, theoretically, if people are insured, we're not going to have to pay those anymore, which means we'll either have lower taxes or improve services with that $3 billion. No one talks about that side, and because, frankly, I think that the right has done a remarkably good job with the help of the insurance companies of focusing only on the cost to government. But the cost to citizens overall is going to be way down.
Congressman, this is Amy Holmes here. You're, you know, going after private insurers and just now the right. But isn't it Blue Dog Democrats who say the Progressive Caucus is out of step with the American people? We know, for example, that 87%, ABC News found this in February, 87% of those polled said that they are extremely concerned about the deficit. And these Blue Dogs are saying they're trying to respond to that concern.
Well, frankly, the Blue Dogs yesterday struck a deal that increased the cost of the bill. I mean, what they said is that by having a weaker public plan, which for your listeners in plain English is someone who's going to compete to pull down prices, what they fought for very hard was that we don't want that public plan to compete as hard as it can, because they said we want its rates to be essentially as high as private insurance companies' rates. I think that and the numbers bear it out, that costs the bill a lot of money. I think that fundamentally some of my friends are arguing two contradictory things. They're saying we want there to be a less vigorous public plan, but we want the cost to be lower. The way you bring down the cost to all of us is you have someone standing in the ring with these private insurance companies. I think they shouldn't. There's not even a need for private insurance companies, but be that as it may, and compete really hard to drag down prices. And consumers are smart enough to choose the best plan. And I think they're going to choose the lower cost plan that the government offers, if only that plan were available.
Let's bring it back to the uninsured for just a second, Congressman. Do you think that covering all of the uninsured is off the table based on the debate right now? I'm trying to decode some of the language here.
Well, it depends. I mean, the Blue Dog deal that was struck yesterday increased the number of small businesses that would be exempt outright. The Senate plan said that they're not going to have either an employer or an individual mandate, meaning requirement that everyone be insured. So I believe that we're leaving big loopholes in the bill that people are going to be able to drive through. Now,
so mandates off the table, what about subsidy?
Well, let's recognize one thing here. We're going through a process that's trying to get this to the floor of the House and Senate, giving the president his due. What it's argued is if we start getting through these committees, we'll get it to the floor, and perhaps those of us who believe in a different vision will be able to have our influence in the final bill. But yes, these compromises that are being struck are moving us further away from the ideal of universal health care.
And it sounds like the White House really picks up the phone if the Blue Dog Democrats call, but I don't know about Waxman and the progressives. Anything you want? I characterize it as a personal issue, but I wonder if it's more of a political strategy issue.
No, I think it's just a political imperative, John. I mean, frankly, when you have every single Republican in the House of Representatives, almost to a man and woman, saying we're not going to vote for anything, it gives them an enormous amount of clout.
But Congressman, Democrats, they have a healthy majority in the House. You don't need Republicans to vote for it.
Well, you have a healthy majority until a handful of Blue Dogs and maybe more. Remember, between the Blue Dogs and the so-called New Democrats, that's over 100 votes in the House.
Difficult math. One thing before we go, congratulations on your engagement, Congressman.
Well, thank you.
Reading some of the news fine print there, that's Congressman Anthony Weiner, Congressman of New York's 9th Congressional District, talking about what's in it for progressives in the health care debate. Thank you so much, Congressman.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry, and Amy Holmes, let's get a little personal here, okay? What's disgusting about fat, okay?
When it's in your food.
It's good when it's in your food.
It just ends up on your body.
When it's in your body, what's disgusting about it is it just sits there and does nothing. It's supposed to store energy, right? So it doesn't do anything. It just sits there. But what if you could find fat that actually burned energy, little oil burners that existed elsewhere in your body that
sounds
actually
too good to be true.
Increased your metabolism. Well, it's not completely correct that the only thing fat does is store energy. There's a type of body fat called brown fat that actually burns calories. Earlier this year, we learned that adults have it, babies have it, animals have it. And the latest developments in brown fat are going to be released in the online version of the journal Nature. Researchers at Harvard Medical School's Dana-Farber Cancer Institute have decoded the recipe for little brown fat oil burners inside your body. And joining us to discuss the research and its implications is health reporter and special correspondent for The Takeaway, Rachel Gottbaum. Rachel, this brown fat business sounds pretty important to me.
It has the potential to be very important. At this point, it's important for babies because it regulates their temperature because they can't regulate it on their own, and it generates heat.
And it's living tissue that actually contains fat, but it also burns energy.
That's right. What it does is it takes away the energy from regular fat, and regular fat becomes skinnier because basically it's this sort of war between who is going to get the energy from the body. Brown fat takes the energy away from, you know, your regular fat cells.
And how important is this? I mean, you've talked with people who were involved in the study, involved at Dana-Farber.
First of all, just to understand a little bit of the history here. A little bit of the history is the following. We knew we had this brown fat in babies, but just until recently, we realized, my God, adults have it too. So those were the findings in April. What these researchers at Harvard have done is actually created this stuff. They have engineered it and created synthetic cells, which they have put into mice and shown that this stuff may be working.
And this isn't simply about doing something in a petri dish. This is about combating overweight, obesity, a very serious public health problem.
Absolutely. And the researcher, Bruce Spiegelman, who's a professor of cell biology, who's the lead author on this work, explains the potential that if we can harness brown fat, what it can do for health.
It is a straightforward, perhaps the most straightforward way to fight obesity and obesity-linked illnesses like diabetes and certain cancers, to promote the development of a cell type whose natural job is to counteract obesity.
That's pretty important.
Now, Rachel, call me skeptical, but I'm envisioning like people with these big brown fat tumors if we start injecting them with it. I mean, is this safe even if it could work?
Well, so really, we're just in the infancy of this research. So what these researchers have done is they've essentially transplanted cells that they've conditioned, cells that were going to do different things, and they've made them cells that become brown fat in mice. In humans, it's a different story altogether. They have taken baby foreskin and created brown fat cells, and Spiegelman explains this.
We showed that we could take human cells from foreskin, grow them in a dish, add these two factors, and they turn on all the properties of brown fat. So we made, in a sense, artificial human brown fat from foreskin because people tend to throw those away when they're not using them for decorative purposes.
Spiegelman's got quite a sense of humor there. So we're taking circumcised tissue, right, and in a kind of a stem cell modality, turning it into this brown fat? Is that the idea?
Well, yes. I mean, stem cell, the idea is taking cells that might be directed toward different kinds of cells, changing cell identity. Yes, these scientists are changing cells' identity. The difference here is that with the human tissue, they've just created these cells in a petri dish. With the mice, they have done it and actually transplanted cells and shown that they can grow tissue. So that's where we're at with the science.
At this point, but it sounds like it's pretty far off before it has human application. So we can't just sit around eating potato chips and getting fat, hoping we'll get brown fat one day.
Yeah, I mean, basically the next steps are the following. What these researchers hope to do is to find a drug target that will create these cells naturally in the body. And they think they will do it so that instead of transplanting these cells into the human body, they will actually find something that can make drugs that you can take a pill and then, you know, create more brown fat in your body and counteract
and either create the tissue yourself, which will convert your own fat, or create other tissue that will actually increase your metabolism and thus reduce your actual weight and propensity towards obesity. Is that the idea?
Yes, absolutely.
All right.
Is that, and what's interesting about the research is that it found that skinnier people had more brown fat. And it also found that when people were exposed to the cold, this fat was more likely to be activated. And it has the potential to, if a small amount, to cut 20% of caloric intake. The next step for these scientists, beyond finding out if they can find a drug target, is to see if their engineered fat really counteracts obesity in mice. And, you know, Spiegelman said that's going to take a few years.
And that's the holy grail there. Rachel Gutbaum, health reporter and special correspondent for The Takeaway, talking about brown fat, the actual triggers that might produce brown fat in human bodies to combat obesity. It's a report in the current issue of the journal Nature online. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Positive news on ugly fat. More good news from Amy, who's got some of the news stories we're following this morning.
Fresh numbers on the job market this morning. New claims for unemployment benefits were up more than expected last week. Unfortunately, bad news. Economist Peter Morici says some cities are faring better than others, though.
The Midwest is the place not to be right now. Other parts of the country will recover more rapidly from the recession. Quite frankly, moving from Detroit to Los Angeles, Detroit to New York, or Detroit to Miami will increase the prospects of finding a job.
Sounds like moving from Detroit to anywhere. The Commerce Department says 584,000 people filed for jobless benefits last week. And in Washington, Congress is acting fast to make sure the federal aid that helps pay for those unemployment checks doesn't run out while it's recession in August. Emergency legislation has passed the House, and the Senate is expected to act soon.
Well, that is good news. You have to admit that. Staying on the Hill, House leaders said they reached a shaky deal with conservative Democrats who've been holding up the House health care bill. The deal could cut $100 billion from the plan. Fresh concerns on how to finance the growing federal deficit. This is definitely not good news if you're watching interest rates. Demand was low at a Treasury auction for five-year debt yesterday. The Treasury sold just $39 billion. The deficit is expected to quadruple this year to $1.8 trillion. And we were talking during those U.S.-China talks earlier this week that the Chinese are supposedly taking on that debt. But it didn't look like they bit
right.
yesterday.
And it could mean that interest rates go up to try to entice them.
That's right.
In the Caribbean, the search has been called off for some 60 Haitian migrants still missing after their boat sank. There were more than 200 people aboard when it hit a reef.
So that's some of the stories we're following this morning. All day we're asking you to weigh in on tonight when President Obama, Skip Gates, and Jim Crowley get together for a beer. Will beer solve the problem?
Hi, this is Caroline from Massachusetts. It would be wonderful that one beer resolved the entire racism issue. It would be a miracle. Look forward to seeing that.
Also look forward to visiting a U.S. Army base in Afghanistan coming up next.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Freeman Foundation.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to celebrating personal responsibility and to proving its own with a comprehensive array of home, auto, and life insurance products. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility, what's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway.
Good morning, everyone. I'm John Hockenberry here with Amy Holmes. On this program, we tend to call it Obama's War, the offensive in Afghanistan. 4,000 U.S. Marines launched a major offensive against the Taliban in southern Afghanistan earlier this month. It's a part of Obama's surge to focus on Afghanistan as we withdraw from Iraq. U.S. forces have a dedicated string of logistical bases now situated out there in the thick sand of Helmand Province in Afghanistan. And these bases are all important. Without their support, the Marines wouldn't be able to function for long. Aaron Schachter is Middle East correspondent for PRI's The World. He joins us now, and he's embedded with an Army medevac unit at one of these logistical bases, Camp Dwyer in Helmand Province, where he joins us from. Good morning, Aaron.
Good morning, John. How are you?
Give me a sense of how this sort of infrastructure and supply chain is working from your perspective as an embed. And we should sort of point out that the mission here is to ultimately develop the sort of civilian infrastructure to support the Afghan government. How's all that going?
Well, I am with a very specific unit, as you mentioned, the medevac troops, and their job is to make sure that the Marines are safe and secure, and if Marines or locals are injured, that they are transported as quickly as possible to hospitals here at Camp Dwyer or a major hospital at Kandahar. Just yesterday, we went out on a flight in the middle of the evening, in the middle of the night, and picked up an Afghan national, a local national, as they're called. He had a bit of a tangle with Marines a little bit south of here and ended up getting shot in the stomach and was transported back here to Camp Dwyer. It's an amazing place to try and work for these guys. As you mentioned, there's a lot of sand, but it's not sand like you would find on the beach. They call it moon dust. If you can imagine New York City or any big city after a snowstorm, the kind of slush that forms on the streets, that's what the sand is like. So when you step down in it, it kind of explodes as if you were stepping into a snowdrift.
So Aaron Schachter, forget the Taliban here. I mean, one of the big enemies are just the conditions on the battlefield. Here's Captain Matt Partkia, who's an Army medevac unit in the company that you're embedded with.
It's been really hard on our equipment out here. We've had to swap aircraft pretty regularly because it does cake everything. And it gets into some of the vital components on the aircraft that keep it flying in the air. So we'd have to swap aircraft pretty regularly out here so we can go back to get washed and maintenance.
How frustrating is that for the troops, Aaron Schachter?
It's a very hard thing to deal with. They're having to, as he mentioned, clean the helicopters very frequently. It gets in all the equipment. And even the slightest wind kicks the dust up, and they're never quite sure whether they can fly or not because the visibility between the ground and about 15 feet above the ground is wildly different from the visibility above. And so they're constantly having to make decisions on whether they can fly or not. Just the other day we went up in almost zero visibility on the ground, and above the dust storms there was a 3-mile visibility. So it's a constantly tricky situation for these guys.
Aaron, this is Amy Holmes here. And, you know, Afghanistan, after all of the attention on Iraq, sort of became the forgotten war for a lot of American people. But a combat Marine reporting in the Wall Street Journal says that actually more coalition soldiers have died in July than in any previous month in the 9-year war in Afghanistan. What is the reality that you're seeing working with this medevac team?
Well, I've been here with a couple different units. I was here with the Marines a month ago and definitely saw the effects of what you're talking about. The Taliban or the insurgents are laying more roadside bombs, more sophisticated roadside bombs. They just don't stop. And what one of the medevac guys told me, who was in Iraq 2 times, is that the Taliban here just will not stop. In Iraq, the helicopters would come in, troops and soldiers would come in, and the Iraqi insurgents would run away. The people here do not run away. And it's made the job of the soldiers and troops here very, very difficult. One of the guys here told me that they are flying, the medevac unit is flying more missions in a week in southern Helmand. Here, where I am, there are just 2 units. So that's 3 helicopters are flying more missions in a week right now than in all of Iraq.
Wow. I mean, you know, Aaron Schachter, the advantage that the Taliban have is that they are so tough as soldiers, as you've just described there. The technological advantages that the coalition forces have, that's something else entirely. Here's Lieutenant Colonel Blackwell, who commands the 3rd Battalion of the 82nd Aviation Regiment, which is a meta-cavalry unit, talking about the technological advantages such as they are.
If a ground soldier can see first, meaning he can see the enemy before he sees him, if he can talk to his people, if he can decide, and if he can start action before the enemy does, then he's got a tremendous advantage.
Aaron Schachter, does that mean that morale is good? Do soldiers have a sense that they're accomplishing their mission, or is it still a bit of the fog or dust of war circumstance right now?
Well, I think it's mixed. There are mixed emotions on the technology that the Lieutenant Colonel was talking about. It's called the Land Warrior, and it's kind of a networking system for all the soldiers and the command posts. So soldiers and their commanders can see the battlefield all at once. Now, it's a great thing for commanders, but soldiers are saying this is 10 pounds of extra weight that we have to carry, and it doesn't do that much more for us. They're still excited about the fight. They're still looking forward to defeating the Taliban here. They call the enemy. But they're a little frustrated about being guinea pigs.
Well, frustrations there. Aaron Schachter on the challenges for 4,000 U.S. Marines in Helmand Province, Afghanistan. Aaron Schachter is embedded with an Army medevac unit at the logistical base Camp Dwyer in Helmand Province. And if you want to see what Aaron Schachter is seeing there in Afghanistan, you can go to our website, thetakeaway.org, to see pictures that he sent us from his recent embed. And here's some of the news stories we're following this morning. Amy?
House leaders say they've reached a shaky deal with Blue Dog Democrats who'd been holding up the House health care bill. The deal could cut $100 billion from the plan. Pregnant women, health care workers, and children older than 6 months old should be first in line for H1N1 vaccines. That's what health officials are recommending. Dr. Anne Schuchat oversees the CDC's flu vaccination programs.
This is a situation of supply and demand and making sure that we can have a vaccine go where it's needed most.
Health officials expect a spike in H1N1 cases later this year. John?
So a little more from Afghanistan. The Taliban is telling voters there to stay away from next month's elections. A web statement threatens to block roads to polling stations and says the vote is part of what the Taliban calls a failed American strategy for the nation. The military in Nigeria, on a story we've been covering this week, says it smashed the headquarters of a radical Islamic sect after 5 days of fighting that has left hundreds dead. The leader of the sect is reportedly on the run, but human rights groups reportedly have some questions about all the tactics.
They have some concerns. Yep. In business news, the numbers don't look good for two oil companies. ExxonMobil says, oh, poor oil companies. ExxonMobil says today its second quarter profits fell about 60% from last year, and oil giant Royal Dutch Shell posted a 70% drop in its second quarter profits compared to last year.
Markets are open. The Dow is up about 78 points in early trading. I don't know if it's reacting to the oil prices, but the global question on the minds of people today, can beer solve the problem of race between President Obama, Skip Gates, and Jim Crowley? We have some experts to talk about that, and Femi Okeh actually found some real beer drinking experts. That's coming up in 10 minutes.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Amy Holmes.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And all during the discussions about auto bailouts and what's going to happen to the manufacturing industries there in the state of Michigan around the city of Detroit, employment held steady. But then last month, the bottom fell out. The unemployment rate in Detroit jumped almost 3 full percentage points. Detroit, Michigan has an unemployment rate that stands at 17%. Mm. It's the highest of any major city in the United States. Our friend Bankole Thompson is in Detroit. He's still got a job. He's senior editor at the Michigan Chronicle. 17%, Bankole, that is really a serious double-digit unemployment rate. How are people feeling about that this morning?
Thank you very much, John. I think people are very extremely upset because they're looking for ways to see how the city's economy or the state's economy can be restored, and they're not seeing it. And there is the president's economic recovery program, but people are still looking for this to filter through their neighborhoods in their communities here in Detroit and other communities across the state. But it's not happening. It's taking too much time, and I think people are running out of patience.
Well, Bankole, we were talking with Dan Gross of Newsweek, who is describing that maybe the recession is over earlier this week, but he was also saying that there are structural changes going on in the economy. This will be a jobless recovery. It sounds like you're seeing those structural changes. Jobs aren't going to be returning here.
Well, when you talk about how the recession is over, I don't think people will believe it, because if you talk to people who are filing for bankruptcies almost every day, the bankruptcy rate is increasing. They don't believe that the recession has ended. I mean, there's talk about the fact that, well, this recession is perhaps the jobs will start to come in next year, but people are not believing it. I think people are very upset, given where we are in the state of Michigan, and especially in Detroit. It's been hardest hit. It's the largest metropolitan city in the state of Michigan here, and it's been, it's taken the hit on a number of directions. I mean, this is the home of the automotive industry, and for a long time we have depended on only one industry, and I think one industry had always had a monopoly, and now it, like you said, the bottom is selling off, and it has put the state at a very disadvantaged position. And what the state is trying to do now is, the governor is talking about diversifying the economy, moving us away from the manufacturing industry, which has had an impact on the lives of a lot of people in Detroit.
Which, Bankole, leads me to my question. Can Detroit be saved? Recently Time magazine ran a photo series called Remains of Detroit, and Bankole, those photos, they looked like some apocalyptic toxic wasteland, something out of Mad Max. Can Detroit ever rise again?
Oh, definitely. I read that piece that the magazine did. Detroit can rise again. I think, I mean, when you survey urban centers across this country, I mean, you could see the same quote-unquote wasteland. But I think Detroit can come back again. I think what needs to happen is that, again, you cannot divorce what is happening in Detroit from what is happening at the state level. I mean, you know, the interesting thing is that Detroit is not the only city suffering. I mean, even suburban neighboring cities in the state of Michigan are also taking the hit in foreclosures. They're also taking the hit in job losses. So if Detroit coughs, those other suburban cities have a cold. So I think you cannot divorce what is happening in Detroit from what is happening at the state level. But I think Detroit can come back. We just elected a new mayor, taking over the reins of the former mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, and the political turmoil that the city went through. And this new mayor is talking about creating jobs because he's an entrepreneur.
Right. Well, and that's definitely going to have to happen. The post-Kwame Kilpatrick era is only a positive there. Bankole Thompson, senior editor at the Michigan Chronicle, talking about the Detroit unemployment rate of 17%, the highest of any major city in the country. Thank you, Bankole.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual, dedicated to helping safeguard businesses and employees through comprehensive insurance products and services. More information at libertymutualgroup.com. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
I'm Amy Holmes here with John Hockenberry. You're listening to The Takeaway. So, John, tonight, finally, President Obama, Skip Gates, and Jim Crowley will be sitting down for a cold, icy beer. Do you think we can all just get along? Will they work it out?
Beer Hall 1, I guess it would be called, right?
Exactly. Our own Femi Oke asked some expert beer drinkers, and we'll hear from her in just a moment. But first, let's get more of the morning's top stories. John?
There are top stories beyond beer at the White House? Oh, certainly there are. Jobless numbers are out. 584,000 Americans filed new unemployment benefits last week. It's a jump from last week, but the Labor Department says not to read too much into the increase. It's complicated, but basically the numbers are strange because of the way they're crunched. It's a statistical anomaly. The overall trend is fewer layoffs.
Speaking of unemployment, Congress is working hard to make sure jobless benefit accounts don't go broke while lawmakers are out of town in August. Emergency legislation is moving ahead to push more than $14 billion to unemployment programs and other priorities. Court arguments are today over the fate of a young Guantanamo Bay detainee. A judge will decide whether he goes home to Afghanistan or faces prosecution right here in the United States. The prisoner is accused of a grenade attack on American troops. The judge has questioned the case against him.
Here's a story that could affect 70 million children. The Indian government has passed legislation that could guarantee universal education for children, or it's considering it anyway. More than a third of India is illiterate. Some 70 million children get no schooling at all. Following all these stories and more this morning.
The Takeaway is Femi Oke is just back from some late night bar hopping. Are you feeling okay
this
morning?
That's news.
Yeah. This just in. Good morning, everybody. How are you? I was doing research, Amy and John.
Just research.
Yes, absolutely doing some research. So, of course, tonight at 6 p.m., there's going to be a beer summit at the White House. So I actually went out to sample what the beer drinkers in New York thought about the summit. So let me set the scene for you first of all. This is the Emerald Bar in Soho in New York. And I know what you're thinking.
Sounds like
Amy
a hopping place.
Yeah, it's very hopping. I am so far out of my comfort zone going up to a bar talking to strange men, but I forced myself for the Takeaway.
Never done that before.
I spoke to about 40 people over a couple of bars, and overwhelmingly, the president's idea got 100% approval rate. Have a listen here to Daniel at the Emerald Bar.
I thought it was interesting how you discussed race over beer. That was the most important thing. Like, let's get the white dude and the black dude come to the White House and we'll have some beers over it. You know, like, it seems kind of ridiculous. No, wait. No, is it ridiculous? No, it's actually quite awesome.
He sounds a little skeptical
awesome.
There.
So the phrase that was being thrown around for the last week or so, racial profiling, but I discovered a new kind of profiling last night. You look at somebody, you gather what kind of beer they might drink. That is beer profiling. Back to the Emerald Bar.
So we get Skip, the Sarge, and Barry all having a beer.
I profile Obama as an IPA man, but that's a personal.
You like IPA? He's drinking Bud. I'm telling you.
I think he's a beer and a shot kind of guy. It's got to be Miller.
Miller is trash, so don't worry about
it. No, Miller's American. Can't go seasonal. If he orders a summer ale, it's over. No one will ever take him seriously again.
They are way into this.
It went on for 20 minutes, this discussion. I am saving you from the entire discussion. But the White House has ended the speculation the president will actually be drinking Bud Light. But over at the Reed Bar, this is in Tribeca, New York, the conversation went to how many beers are they going to be drinking at the
many?
Summit? How
yes,
many?
Well,
so we go to Sam and then on to Daniel.
Just one.
Just one?
Just one, yeah.
One beer is not going to do anything. Not enough alcohol.
How many do we need?
I think Obama probably needs about four. He probably hasn't had a drink in like 10 years. The professor probably needs like two, and the cop probably needs about a 12-pack.
Okay. Sounds like they've had a few themselves.
Yeah, that's beer profiling.
Well, scientifically, there are 12-pack for the cop, yep.
And of course, the punditry isn't just for the cable TV shows. Let me leave you with a bit of punditry from Dan at the Emerald Bar at the scene tonight.
The table will have three beers on it. And they will sit down at the table, and the beers will be there, and they will drink those beers. And whatever happens in the time it takes to drink those beers will be it.
That's Dan with the last word.
I'm imagining a kind of a sterile event there at the White House, I would say.
He doesn't think it's going to be as hopping as the Emerald Bar and the Reed Bar there in New York.
Well, thanks for jumping into it and taking the risk out there at the bars in New York. Thanks, Femi.
You're welcome.
So in the studio with us, we've got Garrett Oliver, brewmaster, Brooklyn Brewery. Let's talk to the brewmaster, the brewmeister, about the question of what kind of beer actually will bring us reconciliation later today at the White House. Good morning, Garrett.
Good morning.
And of course, we've been speculating, was the choice of Bud, was that something that was poll tested or focus grouped? If you're the Goldilocks of picking a beer, what beer is not too fancy pants, not too plumber's pants, but just right, the Docker sweet spot?
You will not be surprised to hear that I think Brooklyn Lager would be exactly the beer, you know, for such an occasion. People forget now, unfortunately, the big so-called American brewers are no longer American-controlled. They're Belgian,
That's
South
right.
African, and Canadian. And so I was a little surprised.
Bud is owned by a German company, a Belgian company now, right?
Yeah, yeah, or Brazilian, depending upon your point of view.
Interesting.
So tell us, what does Barack drinking Budweiser, what does that say?
I don't think it says anything because there isn't really any flavor in the can. So, you know, we're talking about real beer here, and I think that it is only real beer that's going to bring you true reconciliation. I have to admit, I do beer profile people.
Oh, you do?
I do.
And
I
what
mean,
do you find?
I find that if I see somebody drinking something interesting, India Pale Ale, IPA, which has a sharp bitterness, you know, it wakes you up.
So,
and you're going to start thinking about
hold
things.
On then. So Crowley and Gates, drinking Red Stripe and Blue Moon, are more interesting than the president, in your view.
Well, you know, I do love our president, but I think he might have to think a little bit more about his beer choices.
And Garrett, last night, a lot of people were saying that the president, they were actually criticizing the president as being a light drinker. What's the lightest, whitest beer as a way of actually putting him down?
Well, I mean, Bud Light would pretty much do it. It does have the flavor of air, pretty much. So, you know, that's one direction to go in. I think these guys need something with a little bit more substance, because hopefully they'll have a substantial conversation. Over a Brooklyn Lager, you could actually become friends.
That's plug number two. We've got 3 minutes to go in the show. When has beer helped, though? Is there any a precedent for beer actually assisting people coming to terms with some very serious sort of issues between them?
Well, pretty much the United States was founded over beer. Our founding fathers were all brewers. So Harvard University, actually, then Harvard College, actually had its own brewery by the 1670s, and the first president of Harvard was dismissed. Why? Didn't make enough beer for the students.
And Garrett, you know, I've actually read that our, you know, founding fathers and the first pilgrims were always a little bit drunk because of the water quality. You'd get sick from the water. Is that true?
Well, people drank beer from the time they got up in the morning until they went to bed, men, women, and children. So, you know, that certainly lent a certain flavor to the day.
So if Officer Crowley and Gates were both drunk on the porch that night, that would have changed the whole tone.
Right. We might have had kumbaya and hugs there.
Yeah, right.
Garrett, if you had to profile us here in the studio, which beers would we drink?
Oh, I think that I'm looking at you guys, and actually, I've listened to you guys a lot. I think you've got spark to you,
right.
And I think that you're going to be drinking things that have complexity and richness and get into some real conversation.
Very nice, very flattering. You're quite the diplomat. So could they drink too much beer? I mean, we know that beer leads to bar brawls, right?
Well, the president is a very busy man, so I'm sure there's only so much time that they have, and I think that they should make it count. And I think that hopefully at the end of this whole thing, they can walk out of there and shake hands. And having had a beer together, it does bring people together.
You know, we've been talking sort of humorously about all of this. But, you know, in some ways, it kind of demeans the ritual of beer in the sense that there's going to be a photo op. I mean, those guys are there basically helping Barack Obama get out of his political jam. I mean, in a sense, beer is just a set piece. It's not really central to this at all.
Well, I think it's a symbol because people, many of the best times in your life you have around a table, and hopefully you have something nice to drink in front of you. Maybe you have some food. And, you know, after 9/11, I gave a talk in London, and I said, you know, maybe what we do as brewers is not the most important thing in the world, or maybe it is, you know, because it really brings people together. Sitting down calms you and makes you think a little bit deeper about what it is you really think and what it is you want to say.
And I guess let's remember Crowley was the one who suggested let's sit down for a beer,
right? Yeah. Dude, down!
Well, they say in vino veritas.
Hands behind your back. Here's a beer.
So, you know, which brings me to why beer? I mean, I guess if they did a shot of vodka, they would be sort of like old Soviet alcoholics or something.
She raises vodka with a minute to go.
I did not say that. I want everybody to remember. I did not say that.
Oh, God.
But, if you remember the old term, in vino veritas, in wine there is truth. But, of course, in beer there's conviviality, and that's a completely different kind of feel to it.
Garrett Oliver, brewmaster of Brooklyn Brewery, thanks so much for coming into the studio, and thanks to Femi for braving the bars of New York City.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of courage there. It showed a lot of courage
on
Femi's part. Yeah. So what do you think? Will the drink solve the problem? Stephen Quincy Mass emails us, the beer summit is more sensitive than the Korean negotiations. I hope they aren't drinking any atom bombs. And Baratunde twitters, alcohol always solves problems. Right. Vodka shots ended the Cold War. President Obama is a genius. What's your take? Let us know on your website, on our website, thetakeaway.org. And while you're there, you can read a post from Sheila Heen, author of Difficult Conversations. She's also a lecturer on negotiations at Harvard about all this stuff.
I'm Amy Holmes.
I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You know, you can catch the show live Monday through Friday. Thanks for listening. If you have any feedback or think there's any stories we should be covering on The Takeaway, contact us at 1-877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. See ya.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.